From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. America's esteemed magazine, The New Yorker, is getting a new editor. She's Tina Brown, the editor of Vanity Fair. And everyone is wondering if she'll bring Vanity Fair's celebrity orientation to The New Yorker. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with John Updike, a longtime New Yorker writer, and with Jeffrey Stokes, former media critic for The Village Voice, who recently profiled Tina Brown. Also, What It Takes. Journalist Richard Ben Kramer tells us about the forces that drive a man to run for president. He's written a new book that examines the presidential candidates of 1988. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie A League of Their Own. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush appeared on a morning talk show today, despite earlier comments that participation in the free media circuit would diminish the dignity of the White House. The president spent an hour and a half on CBS This Morning, fielding questions from a live audience. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
It was an unusual spectacle, 125 tourists seated in the Rose Garden amidst television cameras and Klieg lights. The president, who has criticized his opponents for their frequent appearances on those, quote, crazy talk shows, took questions about the deficit, crime, the environment, taxes, and health care. He deflected questions about domestic problems, blaming Congress for stalling his programs. The president refused to specifically attack his opponents, Bill Clinton and Ross Perot, and when asked how he differed from the pack, he resorted to an explanation of his crime bill, which has been turned down by Congress 2 years in a row. In the end, Mr. Bush said it will come down to who has the temperament and experience to take on problems. While the majority of the questions were friendly, the president grew testy when he was asked about his low approval ratings, which he attributed to a general frustration among most Americans. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
A man has surrendered himself to police in Dallas, Texas, and has reportedly confessed to a shooting attack that killed two people today at the county courthouse in Fort Worth. A 45-year-old man, identified as George Lott, gave himself up at a Dallas TV station where he told news people that he did it because of a divorce case 4 years ago. Two lawyers were killed and two judges were wounded after a man stood up in the spectators' gallery of a courtroom and opened fire with a 9mm handgun. South Africa's largest labor federation said today it will call a nationwide general strike in August, aimed at forcing the country's white minority rulers to turn over power to an interim government. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
The Congress of South African Trade Unions said it will ask its 1.4 million members to walk off the job on August 3rd unless President F.W. de Klerk agrees to an interim government and schedules elections for a new transitional parliament by December. Union leaders did not specify how long the strike would last, but they vowed that it would be the most serious labor disruption in South African history. The planned strike is part of a pressure campaign sponsored by unions, the African National Congress, and other opponents of the white minority government. The ANC today backed down on another threatened protest, saying that it would not attempt to stop a South African team from going to the Summer Olympics for the first time in 32 years. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 36 points to close at 3,354. Advances led to clients by more than 2-to-1 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. American Telephone and Telegraph has reached tentative agreement with two unions representing 125,000 workers. The company and union officials said they won't release details of the contract until a news conference tomorrow. The Communication Workers of America and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers have been working without a contract since the end of May. Harvard University officials said today that a black law professor's refusal to return from a protest leave of absence constitutes a resignation. Professor Derek Bell has been on unpaid leave for 2 years to protest the school's record on hiring minority and female faculty members. David Wright of member station WBUR reports.
Derek Bell was the first black man ever tenured at Harvard Law School more than 20 years ago. For the past several years, he's been outspoken in his belief the school has not tenured enough minorities since. Bell took an unpaid leave of absence 2 years ago to protest the diversity issue. This spring, he renewed his protest, despite a university policy that limits leaves of absence to 2 years. Harvard Provost Jerry Green says the university was not willing to make an exception in Bell's case.
We feel it would be much more appropriate for Professor Bell's aims, which, by the way, we share, if he were to come back and work within the faculty towards those ends.
Green says Professor Bell will have a chance to appeal the decision to the Harvard Corporation, and if that fails, he can reapply in the future. The 61-year-old black professor says that he will appeal, and he hopes to return to Harvard sometime in the future. For National Public Radio, this is David Wright in Boston.
Barely 1 in 5 of the nation's eligible voters turned out for this year's presidential primaries, the lowest level of participation ever. The Committee for the Study of the American Electorate said that the number of people going to the polls actually dropped by about 1.3 million, despite the fact that the voting age population rose by more than 6 million. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's big news in the publishing world. The editor of The New Yorker magazine, Robert Gottlieb, is leaving and will be replaced by the editor of Vanity Fair, Tina Brown. The New Yorker, more than any other magazine, represents America's literary pantheon. It's so literary, it doesn't even have photos. Vanity Fair is famous for its eye-catching photos of celebrities and its profiles of the rich and celebrated. So writers and readers are wondering what this change will mean. It was only 5 years ago that William Shawn, the revered longtime editor of The New Yorker, was replaced by Robert Gottlieb, who had been the head of the book publishing house Knopf. Now Gottlieb says he's leaving because he can't carry on the type of changes desired by the publisher Cy Newhouse. Change? The New Yorker has been famous for its consistency and its resistance to trends. But the circulation and advertising pages of the magazine were down last year. We called one of America's most celebrated novelists, John Updike, who got his start at The New Yorker almost 40 years ago and has been writing short stories and book reviews for the magazine ever since. I asked his reaction to yesterday's news.
As to Tina Brown being named editor, it was almost as surprising in a way as the concept of Ronald Reagan becoming president. Reagan did become president, and Tina Brown is now going to be the editor, and I don't want to prejudge her reign. She certainly has been a successful editor over at Vanity Fair and seems to have the trust of the Newhouse organization.
What seems to be incongruous about the choice of Tina Brown?
Well, I associate her mostly with the very photographic and somewhat scandal-mongering Vanity Fair. And Vanity Fair, in a kind of classy way, has developed in the last 5 or more years as everything the New Yorker tried under Shawn not to be. If you follow me, it's almost an anti-New Yorker in a way, in that it is topical and gossipy and tries to catch our attention with every month with a new murder among the rich. I don't know, there's a kind of National Enquirer feeling about it, whereas The New Yorker, as it had developed under Shawn, was almost a scholarly magazine. It has a kind of literary magazine flavor to it. But, you know, I was thinking a little bit about the New Yorker's origins, and the magazine that Ross and then Thurber and White and a number of others got out in the 20s and early 30s was kind of a sassy magazine, so maybe Tina Brown will bring back some of the original sass into the publication.
What has being in The New Yorker meant for you as a writer? What do you think you've been able to do there that you perhaps wouldn't be able to do in other magazines nowadays?
Well, it's very hard for me to picture my life as a writer without The New Yorker, since I basically depended upon it to support me for most of my writing life. I fell in love with the magazine when I was an early teenager, maybe even a 12-year-old, and aimed myself at getting into its pages and was lucky enough to get into its pages at a fairly young age. And for many years, even up until I wrote Couples, I basically depended upon The New Yorker to support me. The checks they gave for short stories went a long way in the 50s and early 60s, and I'm just very grateful to it, grateful that I happened to please Shawn and the other editors around him. You know, the New Yorker seemed to me then to be made up of very wise, older, men, and I still have a little bit of that attitude toward the New Yorker, that it is made up of wiser, older people, even though most of them are now younger than I.
I think any time the leadership of an organization changes, you wonder what your individual future will be there, and I'm sure a lot of the writers at the New Yorker are worried now. Are you concerned about your future at the New Yorker?
Not really. I'm 60 years old, and I've kind of made my splash and have some savings in the bank, so I don't really need it as urgently as I did when I was 30. Had there been a revolution when I was 30, I would have been very distressed and felt very threatened. But Tina Brown has already said she doesn't intend to go in for radical changes, so my plan would be merely to submit short stories and poems and book reviews as I have been doing, and see what happens. I think if I were a staffer there, yes, I would be worried about my job and what it all meant. She surely will make some changes as she settles in.
When William Shawn left the magazine and was replaced by Robert Gottlieb, there was a protest at the magazine, and there's really nothing of that sort that I know of happening now this time around. What do you think the difference is?
Well, I think in a way this is so stunning that nobody. Also, I believe people are actually almost too stunned to protest, and also, of course, the Newhouse organization has demonstrated already when they put Gottlieb in that they own the magazine and they are free to make editorial changes. So maybe all of the protest kind of went out of the staff 5 years ago. Shawn was, you know, had a very long time there as editor, and he had followed Ross, so there was a kind of long image of the magazine as an inviolate club above it all, above money worries, above reader complaints, you know, kind of really above it. It was a unique place, and that particular kind of uniqueness, I think, went when Shawn went, and now it's just, I wouldn't say one more magazine, but it somehow feels closer to the real world than it did in the Shawn days.
Do you think something was really lost when Shawn left?
The sense of the supernatural was lost, at least for me. He was kind of a magical man who ran the magazine with absolute authority and a very soft touch, and I kind of revered him. I think we all did. He had magic jumps of taste where he would choose something very surprising, and the magazine, in a way, had a surprisingness in the Shawn days that I'm not sure it's had in the last 5 years. So yeah, he was a magical a magical person. Yeah, of course, he was mortal too. He had gotten on in years, and I think probably it was time for a change. It's hard to picture anybody who would have changed it more gently than Gottlieb, himself a very scholarly, bookish man who I think tried to refreshen the magazine within the existing framework. What Tina Brown will and can do with it, I can't imagine.
What were the changes like inside during the 5 years that Robert Gottlieb was the editor?
Well, he was more accessible than Shawn and more forthcoming with his opinions. He wasn't enigmatic in a way that Shawn was, and I think there was more camaraderie in the staff. I myself fairly rarely visit the place, so I didn't feel it so much. But, you know, he was an impulsive, warm guy who wasn't afraid to say what he thought, and the changes in the style of the articles and then even in the look of the magazine, the readers can see as well as I. But it was, I'd say, a more informal, warmer place to work with Bob there.
Would you describe where you see the New Yorker fitting in terms of the contribution it's made to American literature and nonfiction writing?
Well, I think it's existed really as a bridge between the highbrows and the middlebrows that it has offered in the poetry and the fiction and even in some of the journalism, a standard of writing and a complexity of intent that no other popular magazine, general magazine, was offering. Really, there's nothing like it. And if it goes in its present form, I think a very important bridge will be lost between, in a way, the writing world and the reading world, that or the American middle class and the intelligentsia of the country. It was a place where you could see John Ashbery's poems and Nabokov's stories, and yet see it in a kind of glossy, prospering context. And that was its a unique quality, and I would hope that that can be sustained somehow.
Do you still read The New Yorker?
In part. I never read all of it. I do try to keep up with the books and the poems and the fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I often skip some of the nonfiction. It comes every week, and that's a lot of words.
Yeah.
Today's world.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay. Nice to talk to you.
Writer John Updike. We'll be back with more on the changes at The New Yorker after a short break. This is Fresh Air. The editor of Vanity Fair magazine, Tina Brown, was named yesterday to take over as editor of The New Yorker. In the May issue of Spy magazine, she was profiled by Jeffrey Stokes, the former media critic for The Village Voice. We called Jeffrey Stokes, and I asked him if he thought the appointment of Tina Brown to The New Yorker represented a larger trend in magazine publishing.
Well, I think it's a reflection of the way that magazine publishing has headed, that we've seen for a long time, and I think Vanity Fair is simply the sort of flagship of the process, but which began probably most spectacularly with People, of trivializing and celebritizing magazine journalism. The tricky thing that Tina did, and one has to give her credit for, at Vanity Fair, was that she did all those People-ish cover things, and at the same time did manage to produce some quality writing in the magazine, some important reporting.
You profiled Tina Brown a couple of months ago in Spy magazine, and in that profile you described her as equally willing to threaten and to grovel in pursuit of her grail. Examples of how she would threaten and grovel?
Sure. The groveling, the classic example, perhaps, was a letter she wrote to Michael Ovitz, the Hollywood mega agent who produces great quantities of celebrities for her magazine. And she wanted to do a profile of him and wrote this extraordinary letter, which raced around the New York publishing world and was eventually published in Spy, in fact, in I think August of 1990. Saying, you know, oh, we hear Premier is going to do you, and they won't do you fairly. We will do, in essence, anything you want to have you in our magazine. That's the grovel, okay? The threats are generally dedicated, of course, not to people who are potentially her peers or equals in power, but to staffers, writers, underlings in general. Classic story, and actually one that I used in the Spy magazine piece, involved a young writer just beginning to establish himself as a freelancer who'd done some work for Vanity Fair. And he was at a meeting in her office when he casually mentioned that he was had agreed to be interviewed for a profile of her that one of the newsweeklies was doing. And after the meeting, she pulled him aside and said, you know, listen, young man, if you agree to an interview about me, you will never write for this magazine again, and you will never write for any other Condé Nast magazine.
Mm-hmm.
That'll get your attention.
Right. What contributions do you think Vanity Fair has made to the furthering of personality journalism?
Well, I think there's a quite conscious and cynical use of the cover to sell the magazine. I mean, quite often, and it's an interesting phenomenon, you pick it up, you'll see, Starlet A is on the cover. You open it up and you realize that there are two pages of really undistinguished prose by a second-rate Vanity Fair writer about the cover story, while there's 7,000 words about someone you might not even have heard of before. So there's a kind of cynicism in that. I mean, and she's, says this unashamedly, right? I mean, Kevin Costner on the cover gives me the right to do what I want to inside. But Vanity Fair was a leader in that. I mean, they created, its success created the phenomenon, not only of the cover, right, which is one thing, but of the deal. Yes, if you'll give us the cover, if you'll sit still for a photo shoot, then sure you can have quote approval, or sure you can have writer approval, or yes, we won't ask you about your sexuality, or some other subject that you don't want to discuss. And all of that's negotiated ahead of time. So the reporters go out there with their hands tied, and readers are reading pre-censored material.
Can you sum up what you think Tina Brown's greatest accomplishments have been as an editor, and what your greatest criticisms of her as an editor would be?
Sure. I think her greatest accomplishments have been in some way commercial. That is to say, she has sold a lot of copies of a magazine. In the process of doing that, she has found or recruited, at any rate, some very talented writers. She's resuscitated what it seemed to me was a dying genre, which is the true crime story. She's sussed out trends, I think, fairly early on. Menopause, the current menopause boom, right, being a classic example of that. I also think in other ways she was first, in part, I think, because of the limitations of the monthly deadline, to really home in on the so-called character issue of presidential candidates, and that's something that I think newspapers, as well as magazines all over the country, are imitating this year. Sure, she was aided by Gary Hart's inability to keep his pants buttoned, but that phenomenon, I think, is very real, and treating candidates as celebrities rather than as people who represent a package of ideas and a direction for the country. So I think all of that is accomplishment, and some of it is criticism. I think, too, certainly in criticism, one has to deal with the kind of sycophantic treatment that Vanity Fair gave to its favorite subjects, whether they were advertisers or personal friends of its editor.
When you say advertiser, you mean stories about advertisers?
Sure.
Stories about people who advertise in...
Yeah, I mean, here's Ralph Lauren. In 1987, he takes out 34 or 37 pages of ads in the magazine. And in 1988, he's on the cover with this incredible wet kiss of a piece.
Is this something you think other magazines have picked up on, too?
I think other magazines have been less shameless about it, to their credit. Though there's always enormous pressure, particularly when the economy turns down, right, as it did, as it has and is continuing to do for the magazine industry still, at least, not to offend advertisers, and indeed to help them out in ways if you possibly can. And, the sort of silken curtain or Chinese wall or pick your metaphor between editorial and advertising that was established, say, at The New Yorker, right, quite strongly, was just shredded by Vanity Fair.
You know, Vanity Fair and The New Yorker may be poles apart in terms of their identity as magazines, but they're owned by the same person, Cy Newhouse. And, he's decided it's time for a change. Do you have reservations about this kind of conglomeratization of magazine publishing?
Yes and no. I mean, it seems to me to be a danger, more of a danger in the newspaper business than in the magazine business, partly because so many towns are served by only one newspaper. So many cities have only one newspaper. And if they're being dominated by chain coverage, that's a real problem. The magazine business remains pretty diffuse. I mean, you know, Condé Nast may be Gargantua, right, or Godzilla, but Hearst is King Kong, and there are independent rivals and city magazines and independently owned publications that are nationally circulated. I'm less worried about that. I'm also not entirely sure when you talked about the New Yorker and Vanity Fair being antithetical. They aren't quite, you know. I mean, there are pieces in Vanity Fair that you could have set in a different typeface and run in the New Yorker.
That's a really valid point.
You know, and the other way around. I mean, the true crime genre, right? For years, the best and perhaps the only genius at that in the magazine business was Bud Trillin, Calvin Trillin at mm-hmm. the New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that the, and any of those pieces could have run in Vanity Fair, and the other way around, right? On some of, particularly some of the international reporting at Vanity Fair. I think Vanity Fair was driven by the story and the New Yorker by the writer.
Mm-hmm.
And when it worked, when the writing at the New Yorker was as sharp as it has sometimes been, right? You could read John McPhee on oranges, right? And it would be wonderful. You could also read E.J. Kahn, a five-parter on the history of grain, right? And constantly be bruising your forehead on the dining room table as it fell forward. You know, it's, but you would not have seen either of those in Vanity Fair because they didn't have a hot peg.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's a difference. And I don't know how she's going to deal with that. I would hate to see the loss of the quirky, cranky, idiosyncratic story that the New Yorker has really made a niche for.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay.
Journalist Jeffrey Stokes. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ever wonder why a person would want to be president of the United States? What kind of ambition and ego it takes to run? Coming up, we talk about what it takes with journalist Richard Ben Kramer. He spent 6 years writing an epic book about the candidates in the 1988 presidential campaign. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews A League of Their Own, the new movie starring Tom Hanks, Gina Davis, and Madonna. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Calls for some kind of international intervention to determine the cause of spiraling political violence in South Africa appear to be gaining more support. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
The Organization of African Unity, or OAU, today called for an urgent meeting of the United Nations Security Council to discuss recent political violence in South Africa. At its annual summit in Dakar, Senegal, the OAU denounced South Africa's white-ruled government and charged it with fueling recent political violence in the black townships. United Nations Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali said that there was a consensus among the white-ruled government, the African National Congress, and the rival Inkatha Freedom Party for an international presence inside South Africa. Boutros-Ghali said the decision on whether to expand the UN's mediating role or sending a fact-finding mission to South Africa would be brought before the UN Security Council in the next few days. Meanwhile, two British detectives were appointed to work with a special South African judicial commission investigating political violence. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
In Sarajevo, despite sniper fire, aid workers have started handing out military rations brought in on French airplanes this week. French troops have also arrived in the capital to help keep the airport open. Members of the European community say they plan a six-plane operation tomorrow to fly in food, blankets, and tents. A UN official says that several hundred thousand people are still in Sarajevo, which is short of food and medicine, after a three-month-long siege by Serbian forces opposed to Bosnian independence. A congressional task force is accusing Iran of printing counterfeit U.S. $100 bills. A new report says that Syria is helping Iran get the fake bills into circulation. John Greenberg reports.
The report gives no estimate of how much counterfeit money Iran is allegedly printing, but it does say that potentially billions of dollars could soon be in circulation. According to members of the Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare, the bills are showing up mainly in Central Asia and Africa. The task force chairman, Republican Bill McCollum of Florida, says Iran has the means to print high-quality counterfeits, and it has a clear motive.
The fact of the matter is that the Iranian government, in cooperation with Syria, has undertaken a massive counterfeiting campaign in order to alleviate their financial difficulties and pursue economic warfare against the West.
An industry group representing multinational commercial banks says it is unaware of a major counterfeiting operation involving Iran or any other country. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 35.5 points to close at 3,354.10 on volume of 214 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 2 to 1. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, a House committee has cleared President Bush of allegations that he was present at a meeting in Paris 12 years ago when a deal was allegedly made with Iran to delay the release of U.S. hostages. However, officials said that efforts will continue to see if the Reagan campaign conspired with Iran to delay a hostage release and prevent the re-election of Jimmy Carter. Democratic Congressman Lee Hamilton announced interim findings of a task force created earlier this year to investigate the so-called October surprise. Israeli helicopters rocketed a house in a refugee camp in southern Lebanon today. Four children were reportedly seriously injured. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
It was the 25th Israeli airstrike into South Lebanon this year. An Israeli army spokesman said the target in the Rashidiya refugee camp was a base for the Radical Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Palestinians in the camp told reporters it was a welfare center and four children were seriously injured in the attack. The Israeli army spokesman said he could not confirm the casualties. Reports from Lebanon say Lebanese army troops fired anti-aircraft guns at the Israeli helicopters. Israeli military sources say a standby rescue helicopter, which was still on the Israeli side of the border with Lebanon, crashed into the Mediterranean, either from pilot error or a mechanical failure. One Israeli soldier was killed and five wounded. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
House Speaker Tom Foley says that the Bush administration has failed to consult with Capitol Hill about the possibility of sending U.S. military forces to Yugoslavia. Foley said as yet he has not been contacted by the president or anyone else concerning the Yugoslav crisis, and he has no idea of the intentions of the Bush administration. Yesterday, the Pentagon said the U.S. is ready to give fighting air cover to U.N. forces providing aid to Sarajevo. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Did you ever think you should be president? Richard Ben Cramer didn't. When he became a journalist, Cramer started to wonder about presidential candidates. Who are these guys that are confident and ambitious enough to think they deserve to lead the country? Cramer spent the last 6 years trying to answer that question. His new book, What It Takes, profiles six men who were presidential hopefuls in 1988: George Bush, Michael Dukakis, Joe Biden, Richard Gephardt, Bob Dole, and Gary Hart. Cramer is a contributing editor at Esquire magazine. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his Middle East reporting in 1979 for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He wanted to find out who these candidates were as people by talking to them and to nearly everyone who knew them. I told him I thought whatever strengths I have as an interviewer often fail me when I interview politicians, because they sometimes lie and usually turn their life stories into self-mythology. I asked Cramer about his approach.
These are not introspective men. They're people who have never had to think about themselves for 15 minutes in their lives, because they're very outward directed. Their problems were always getting other people to change their attitudes or like them or move in a certain direction. And their internal clock, their internal methods, their habits of being on the planet were the one thing they never had to worry about. So asking them directly, why do you do a certain thing or what makes you this way, never really worked out that well. What I had to do was keep coming back to them, writing what I thought was true and actually showing it to them so that they could tell me how it looked from behind their eyes. I gave them absolute rights of argument, but in order to convince me to change anything, they had to tell me how it really was for them.
How much access did the candidates give you to their campaigns?
Well, it varied from candidate to candidate and from time to time. For instance, with Michael Dukakis, I got very good cooperation until the point when he saw himself as the putative nominee, at which point the bubble, what I call the bubble, really began closing around him. And the only people with access to him were the suits at the front of his plane.
Yeah, why don't you describe what you call the bubble?
Well, this is kind of central to the book. What I found out in this six-year project was that the life that we thrust these men into, I say men because they have all been men in my lifetime, cuts them off from the normal American life that they set out to improve in the first place. We put them in planes where they're hopping around the country for years at a time. All these brilliant advisors in suits around them handing them papers and telling them where to go and whom they're going to see and what they're going to say to those people. And after a while, the candidate can't see outside this circle of admiration around him. Not only that, we can only see the shiny surface that this bubble erects for us. So sometimes it seems to me that we divorce these men from the very life of brilliance that brought them to the point where they could run in the first place.
And you think that the candidate really loses touch with what's happening in the country?
Absolutely. He loses touch with every vestige of reality and every vestige of his former life.
Are there a couple of things that you could mention about George Bush that made you
have a sense of who he is as a person and have helped you understand policy decisions that he's made while in the White House?
Oh, sure. You know, people complain about George Bush in that he doesn't seem to want to use the government to help our society's impoverished or underclass, if you want to call it that, and talks instead about these thousand points of light. And people of my acquaintance can't understand this. They think he must be unfeeling or uncaring. But if you go back into his past, the story that brought made this clearest, made his attitude clearest to me, happened in about 1962 when he'd been made chairman of the Republican Party in Harris County, which is Houston, Texas. And Bush energized the Republican Party, which was a small but growing band at the time. And in fact, they elected their first city councilman, I think the first Republican city councilman ever in the city of Houston. And that fired up the troops even more. And then some months later, there was on the front page of the Houston Post a picture and a story about a terrible event where a baby girl had been bitten by a rat in a Houston housing project. Well, it was, as I say, front page and big play, and the whole city was talking about it. It was a really terrible story. And another man in George Bush's position might have called for improvements to the public housing in the city, or at the least called up the city councilman he'd helped to elect to propose a rat eradication plan, or in some way mounted some assault, some systemic assault on the problems that were illustrated by this story. But George Bush's response was uniquely his. He called up Barbara at home that day and he said, "Bar, do you think we could give that family our baby bed?" Now, Barbara Bush, who hadn't even realized that she and George were not going to have any more children, was kind of unsure, but he insisted. And in fact, he drove home that day, put the bed into the trunk of his car, and took it right over to that family so the little girl would no longer have to sleep on the floor. And that is how George Bush solved that problem.
What does that say to you about him?
It says that he deals absolutely in particulars. You know, he's a man who got to the presidency one friend at a time. He works by personal exertions and personal attentions. And when I see him now, on a personal level, I'm troubled and saddened for him, because he's a guy who is now trying to lead a republic of 250 million citizens and a $1 trillion government and the lone superpower left on the planet, all by personal attentions and personal exertions and kindnesses and invitations to the boat in Kennebunkport or burgers and bloodies in the backyard with Bush. And I can just see him squeezing out the last drops of his energy for us, as he sees it. He is giving over the last and most active years of his life to this quest, which is his, to be the president he saw in himself.
I want to get back to the bed story where George Bush wanted to give this girl his bed. Couldn't that just be to get a little bit more political attention, to have a kind of heartwarming story of which he would be the hero?
No, I don't think so. I think it's an absolute visceral response from him. He was going to solve that problem. He's horrified that this baby had been bitten by a rat. But the problem to him was not that there were rats all over the Houston housing complex, or that the public housing in the city was run down or ill-administered or ill-maintained. The problem for him, he never saw the system that fostered this rat bite. He just wanted to get that baby off the floor.
It's a real problem for a politician who can't see the larger system that causes the problems.
Well, it's with all of these men, their strengths are always their problems and vice versa. I mean, George Bush has made his way in the world by this particularity and personalness of his attentions. And only now, when he gets to the top of the heap and, alas, has only his life's same method to bring to the tasks before him, is he criticized for failure to see the larger picture.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Kramer, and we're talking about his new book, What It Takes, which is his study of six men in 1988 who wanted to be president. And he's also a contributing editor to Esquire magazine. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Richard Ben Kramer is my guest. You're kind of critical of the press corps.
Kind of.
Yeah. Well, you call a lot of the Washington press corps, you know, the reporters who cover campaigns as being character cops, character with a K.
Character with a capital K, yes, ma'am.
Capital K, yeah. What's your problem with them?
Well, my problem is they don't do the work. What they do is they take some little grape nut of a fact. You know, for instance, Gary Hart changed his name. And they will erect this into a giant superstructure on which they hang every episode of the man's life and wrap this up neatly in 40 column inches as a character study, when in fact it's nothing of the kind. Mostly what it is the same stuff that they heard from their lunch buddies at Moe and Joe's or Duke Zebert's in Washington. So I think what the essence of my problem is that the press is now a self-referential mob, and there's no individual responsibility at all. As long as you're operating in the middle of the pack mentality, you can say whatever you want about these guys really without reference to how they see themselves or how those who know them best have seen them over the years.
What do you think of the way the issue of character has been covered during this campaign?
Well, I think it isn't getting any better. I mean, you know, we know a lot more about Bill Clinton's supposed relationship with Jennifer Flowers than we know about his record as governor of Arkansas. And clearly, I mean, if you step back from it even one inch, you can see that Ms. Flowers' story, true or false, Ms. Flowers' be she liar or be she telling the truth, is certainly not much of a part of Bill Clinton's life. The man has given his life to the job that he holds in Arkansas and now to his quest for the White House. If he was messing around, he certainly didn't spend much time at it.
You've been critical of reporters who always want to know, well, what did Bush know about Iran-Contra? I'd like to know that. What's wrong with wanting to know that?
No, I wasn't really critical of the reporters who wanted to know that. I wanted to know that, too. The point that I made in a chapter about Iran-Contra is that that may be the wrong question. There are different ways of knowing in Washington, and Bush is a very subtle and practiced knower of knowledge in the Capitol. And so if he meant to know everything about the case without being culpable of actually being overtly informed, he was perfectly capable of that. There was no reason why Bush would commit the act of informing himself in an official way about the deal with Iran or the secret funding of the Contras, because neither of these matters was on his plate. The only thing he had to know as vice president was that the president was for them. After that, he could know as much as he wanted without being ever putting himself at risk of being culpable of knowing about something that could come out later.
So you think he knew enough to know what he shouldn't officially know?
Exactly. And he's a very practiced hand at this ancient Washington art.
Do you feel like you've emerged from this book any more or less cynical about the state of American politics?
Well, I'm actually a little less cynical, I think. You know, I went in with a kind of practiced and ignorant Washington view that I thought I knew these guys and they were mostly bums, you know, and my task was to find out exactly in what way they were bums. But I lost that attitude because I really marveled at the largeness of these lives and the way people changed their lives for these candidates. It was the joy of this book that almost everybody I talked to was talking about one of the most amazing men they've ever met. And whoever it was, their spouse or their companions in life had long since tired of hearing about this guy. Then comes this woolly-haired reporter who really wants to know everything. And together we're going to sit down and figure out what it is that makes this guy so amazing. So what it did was it changed my relationships from reporter to source into reporter and collaborator, or two collaborators in the search for the source of this man's power. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. You know something that I'm uncomfortable with? This whole sense of, like, who the man is, and that it's not about the suits, it's not about the handlers, and it's not about, you know, all the other people in the White House. But it is, isn't it? Isn't it really also about them, too?
Well, sure, it's
hasn't politics become this kind of collaborative thing? It's more than about just the person who's running for office. It's about the people who put words in their mouths with the speeches and the people who help them decide on policies, the people who advise them, the people who plan their campaigns and tell them what to do if there's a suspicion of an affair or something, you know, who choreograph so much of it.
Yeah, well, all those people are very much a fixture in the life of these candidates. But when it comes down to it, there are episodes when every one of these candidates is out there naked.
Uh-huh.
And all he has to go back to are the events of his life as he has understood it. You know, alas, there's nothing more they can bring into the White House than their own life's method.
Okay, well, Richard Ben Kramer, thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you very much for having me on.
Richard Ben Kramer is the author of What It Takes, The Way to the White House. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel, host of All Things Considered. Coming up on today's program, we'll be hearing from reporter Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem about the wrangling there among the Israeli political parties as Labour's Yitzhak Rabin tries to put together a new coalition government. Also, we'll hear about the state of Utah notifying the federal courts that key portions of its new abortion law, passed in 1991 but never put into effect since they've been under court challenge, are now unconstitutional in view of the Supreme Court's ruling on the Pennsylvania law earlier this week. We'll also hear about the cleanup efforts after the benzene spill in Duluth, Minnesota, and Superior, Wisconsin, and an account of the Boipatong massacre in South Africa from a Zulu point of view. Those stories coming up later from National Public Radio.
You may remember Penny Marshall from TV when she was Laverne, or was that Shirley? Since then, she's made the movies Big and Awakenings, which in turn have made her the biggest female director in Hollywood. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of her new movie, A League of Their Own.
This has been Penny Marshall's dream project for years. But in Hollywood, dream projects bring their own set of problems. More often than not, the director has mooned over her pet for so long that it's become less a story to tell than an object of veneration. And inevitably, all that dewy piety comes through on the screen. That's how it is with A League of Their Own, which is about the All-American Girls Baseball League, an organization that began in 1943. World War II was taking America's star players overseas, and a group of enterprising businessmen decided that Rosie might be able to snag flies as well as she could rivet. The movie imagines a fictitious team, the Rockford Peaches. And naturally, we watch as potential players are gathered from the farms and schoolyards of America, auditioned, and trained not just in baseball, but in makeup and hair. Then, pretty much as you'd expect, we watch them play and improve and head for the World Series. The problem Marshall and her screenwriters face is that, as novel as the idea of women in pinstripes and cleats may seem, it's not novel enough to build a movie on. Baseball is baseball. It's still hits, runs, and errors. It's still sneaking out of the team hotel for a night on the town. It's still locker room pep talks and watching the typically ill-assorted crew of strangers turn into a lean machine. A league of their own is pretty much like every other league, except for the piety. Whenever the movie is about to die of listlessness, Marshall throws in a scene of some boorish male skeptic making fun of the women and then getting shown up for the tiny-minded pig he is. There's only one respite from all this, and that's the role of the team's alcoholic coach, a former star hitter named Jimmy Dugan. Fortunately, he's played by Tom Hanks, who knows how to ball out a ball player even when she's a sweet little blonde named Evelyn.
You let the tying run get on second, and we lost the lead because of you! Now you start using your head! That's that love that's 3 feet above your ass!
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying! There's no crying in baseball!
Why don't you leave her alone, Jimmy?
Oh, you zip it, Doris! Rogers Hornsby was my manager, and he called me a talking pile of pig. And that was when my parents drove all the way down from Michigan to see me play the game. And did I cry?
No, no.
No! No! And you know why?
No.
Because there's no crying in baseball. There's no crying in baseball! No crying!
This movie has such a wealth of actresses, including Gina Davis, who is smart and winning as usual, and Madonna, who is sexy and inept as usual. And yet, the main reason to see it is Hanks. With his grubby beard and an extra pound or two of flesh around the neck, he really looks like a washed-up slugger, and no one can make spitting tobacco juice look more comically grotesque. There are moments in this movie when Hanks seems so overcome by the sheer dullness of what's happening around him that he decides to pull out all the stops, whereupon we get displays of scrunchy-faced physical comedy that are as marvelous as anything in the movies. Penny Marshall directed Hanks once before in Big. She may not be able to do much with baseball, but she's helping to make Tom Hanks our most valuable comic actor this side of Steve Martin.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Spolin and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a comic's view of the presidential campaign. We talk with comic Richard Belzer. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.